Right now, Dr. Katie Lewis from Texas A&M University. I got a chance to hear this talk at our state ag consultants meeting in Louisiana back in February. And Dr. Dan Frommey, our state cotton specialist, had Katie come and give this talk. And probably one of the better talks I've heard about potassium management in cotton. And it's a lot of good information for everybody across the belt from wherever you are. I thought it was a very good talk, very well put together, and a lot of good information for us from a lot of different areas. So at this time, Dr. Lewis.
Well, thank you for the invitation to be here. As you said, my name is Dr. Katie Lewis. I'm located at the AgriLife Research Center in Lubbock, Texas. I have a joint appointment with Texas Tech as well. So this project, I gave you a little bit of background on it. It was something that Dr. Galen Morgan and other cotton specialists across the Cotton Belt started in 2015. And if you noticed, I didn't say extension. I don't have an extension appointment, but I was lucky enough to be involved with the project from the beginning of it. And so I thought today I'd start by introducing potassium. Potassium is something that some farmers may forget about from time to time. Most of them are going to be focused on nitrogen. But potassium is very important. One being that it is required in amount second only to nitrogen. In some cases, particularly in cotton, it can be needed in greater quantities than even that of nitrogen. It is very important as a quality nutrient, so it's involved in fiber maturity. It also mitigates drought and biotic stresses by regulating the leaf stomata, the opening and closing, and how that plant is using water. Especially, so I'm located in the southern high plains where we do have extreme drought periods, and so potassium can play a role, especially during those times of drought. And where we are irrigated, in the southern high plains again, we do have dwindling water supplies, and so potassium may begin to play a larger role in some of those operations. Another benefit or aspect of potassium that we may not think about on a daily basis is the role that potassium plays when it comes to foliar and root diseases. I know we've had some excellent panels this afternoon talking about different diseases, and potassium is involved in that. These pictures were taken by Galen Morgan down in his area in 2012, and from a distance, we definitely can see that we have some potassium symptomology that's showing up. What was really interesting, and I know it's going to be hard to see from the back of the room, but here at the top of this picture on the right was a zero or a check plot, where zero K2O was applied. Down at the bottom of the picture was where we had our highest rate of potassium applied, which was 120 pounds of K2O per acre. What Galen noticed was that in these check plots, we were having a greater incidence of verticillium wilt at this site compared to that higher application rate. So it plays a role in the incidence and severity of verticillium. We've also noticed similar things in the Lubbock region. So a little background on Lubbock, we have anywhere from 200 to 300 part per million potassium in our soil, which is about twice the level of what our critical level is set at. And so we shouldn't be seeing these potassium symptoms, but not only were we seeing some potassium symptomology, but we were also seeing verticillium wilt in this field. And so the two are closely related, tied together. Like I mentioned, potassium is often overlooked, even though it is a key component of most farming operations. We have to think about it. If we're removing potassium, most of our farmers, and I hate to say this because my husband's sitting in the audience, but most of our farmers aren't going out and taking soil samples. I would say a good number are, but the majority are not, and so they don't know what their soil K levels are. That plant is remember, just as much or needs just as much potassium as it does nitrogen. So if we're not replenishing that, then we are going to see a reduction in potassium over time. And these figures here on the bottom, this one on the left, is showing that we have an increase in yields from about 1964 or 84, I believe, to 2014. We're seeing an increase in yields, but both potash and phosphate, their use hasn't increased. But with increasing yields, we should be seeing that increase in fertilizer application. This picture was taken in 2019 from Wellington, Texas, soil that had sufficient levels of potassium, but we were seeing that later season potassium deficiency. And we were able took some plant samples, that it was potassium. Potassium was the culprit in this case. It wasn't a disease that was being mistaken for potassium deficiency, because our potassium levels, leaf concentrations, were 0.2%. To be in the marginal range, it's about 1.5%. So we were well below that, definitely in that low range, and seeing those symptoms. So if we look across the Cotton Belt, I've talked primarily just in the Southern High Plains, but looking across the Cotton Belt, there has been an increase in reports of potassium deficiency. And what we see oftentimes is, especially in our region, we have sufficient soil potassium levels, but yet we still see these later season potassium deficiencies that are showing up because the potassium isn't taken up by the plant at levels that it needs to be. There are several theories on this. Mine, being a soil scientist, may be more related to we're overestimating what our malic free extractions are actually determining. So if we have 300 parts per million K according to that malic free test, it may be extracting some potassium that's not truly plant available or won't become available during the growing season. Then it also could be go back to varieties as well. Over time, we've seen an increase in yields, and in many cases, faster fruiting, which would increase the potassium demand over a shorter period of time. And so both of these could be leading to why we're seeing that in-season potassium deficiency. The objectives of the results that I'm going to be discussing today were to evaluate the impact of potassium application methods. We're looking at both a broadcast dry application and a knife-injected liquid application at different rates on cotton yield and fiber quality. And then based on these findings, our end goal was to reevaluate what our current critical level was using that Malic 3 test. From 2015 to 2017, we had what we considered to be single-year sites and multi-year sites. Hunter Frame was in charge more of the multi-year sites. Galen was working on the single-year sites, and these sites, like I said, across the Cotton Belt, and we had, I'm not going to list all their names here, but just about all the cotton specialists across the Cotton Belt were involved in this project. Texas had multiple locations. Galen Morgan had some locations in his region in Williamson County that we'll talk about here in a second. I had locations in the Lubbock region, just south of Lubbock. Here they are, all listed out, and I know at the back of the room it's going to be difficult to see, but in total across those 3 years, we had 23 site years, and in 2015, those sites included Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana. We had the two Texas locations, that being in Dawson County and Williamson County, and then we also had Virginia. In 2016, those locations were similar, except we also had sites in Oklahoma and North Carolina. I believe there were some herbicide issues in 2015 at those two locations. And then the sites were similar in 2017 with the addition of a Mississippi site as well. But what you'll notice looking at this, across these 23 site years, we had a range of irrigation with the majority of them being rain-fed, but we also had furrow irrigation. And at the Lamesa or Dawson County site in Texas, we had subsurface drip. In addition to different irrigation, we also represented a wide range of soil textures, ranging from fine sandy loams to clays. So we really represented a good chunk of those different soil series that cotton's being grown. The treatments, like I said earlier, that we're looking at were two different application methods, so broadcast application that was incorporated to at least 3-inch depth, and we were using granular KCL, so 0060. And then we had a knife-injected application that was placed 4 inches from the seed at a 6-inch depth. We were using a liquid formulation of KCL, which is 0015. And then we had 5 different application rates, 0, 40, 80, 120, and 160 pounds of K2O per acre. All the plots received equivalent amounts of both nitrogen and phosphorus, and that was based on the soil test recommendations. And the fertilizer was applied 2 to 4 weeks prior to planting. As far as the data that was collected, I drew the short straw. I don't know if Galen's in here or not, or Bob, but I drew the short straw and have been summarizing this data set. And it's a very large one because we collected large amounts of data. But with a project like this, it really has been beneficial to have all the soil data, plant data, as well as our lint yields and fiber quality. But we collected soil samples prior to fertilizer application in each of those 3 years. Sampling depths were 0 to 6, 6 to 12, and 12 to 24 inches. And then all of the soil samples were sent to the Texas A&M soil testing lab, and a Malic 3 extraction was used to determine the potassium levels. We planted Delta Pine 1321 in 2015, and due to lack of availability, we switched to Delta Pine 1522 for 2016 and 2017. And then as far as the data, plant data, we were looking at leaf potassium levels at first bloom, lint yield, and fiber quality. All right, so we're going to start into the data. And what we have here is we're looking at the Malic 3 potassium levels in the 0 to 6 inch depth, 6 to 12 inch depth, and 12 to 24 inch depth. And then cumulatively from 0 to 12 and 0 to 24. But we'll focus on these 3 depths. The first thing, if you can see it, that you would notice is that we're going to see a reduction in the majority of our locations in potassium levels from the 0 to 6 inch depths to the 12 to 24 inch depths. Except there are a few locations, Arkansas being one of those, where we saw the opposite of that. We see an increase in potassium levels from the most shallow depth to the deepest depth. But the majority of the time, because where that potassium is being taken up, and you have to think about where potassium is being applied in the 0 to 6 inch depth, it's not going to move much in the soil profile, so our greatest concentrations are going to be in the 0 to 6 inch depth of the soil. And from here on out, I've broken up the results. We're going to look at leaf K and lint yield, but we're going to look at it based on the soil K levels at the 0 to 6 inch depth. So we'll look at results for these locations that range from 30 to 100 milligrams of K per kilogram of soil, and then we'll look at them at these other locations separately. The reason for doing that is based on the critical level. So the soil testing lab in College Station, using a Malic 3 extraction, their critical level is set at, or was set at, 125 parts per million potassium. And so I've broken it up into those sites that should have been responsive versus the ones that we didn't expect to be responsive due to their high soil potassium levels. So we'll start first with leaf potassium. So oftentimes we take leaf samples to indicate whether or not there is a deficiency, more or less just a tool to determine whether or not what we're seeing in the field is actually a potassium or any other nutrient deficiency. The locations that have a box around them indicated where we saw a positive response. So of these, I think 20 different, if we look at both the broadcast and injected, 20 different site years, I guess you could say, only 4 of those had a positive response to the application of potassium. So across the top here, we have the 5 different rates of potassium that was applied, and then we have the percentage of K. Another thing that you'll notice, we collected these at first bloom. Our potassium level should have been right around that 1.5% K range if we were in that sufficient or marginal level. Most of our locations where we have 0 K applied are well below that. But still, only 4 of those were responsive to the addition of potassium. If we look at the sites that are greater than the critical level, greater than 125 milligrams per kilogram, We did not see any positive responses to the addition of potassium according to the leaf potassium levels. These boxes that are here, those are a significant effect because of the application, but wasn't a positive response to that application. Moving on to lint yield. Of the sites that were in that responsive category, how we marked them off, only 36% of those had a positive response. So these are the sites that should have been responsive, less than 125 milligrams of K per kilogram in the soil, and only 36% of those. The majority of them where we did see a positive response in the broadcast, we also saw a positive response to the injected K. However, Virginia, we only saw a positive response with the broadcast application, but not the injected. In North Carolina, there was not a response with the broadcast application of potassium, but there was with the knife-injected potassium. And with most of these, we either saw that maximum yield or greatest response at 40 pounds of K2O per acre or 80 pounds. Most of them were in the 80-pound range where we saw the greatest response to yield. Looking at the sites that were greater than 125 milligrams of K, we only had three responsive sites. One of those was Oklahoma in 2016, and that was to the with the broadcast application of K2O, and then Lubbock in 2015 and 2016 with a knife-injected potassium application. So what do we do with this data? Lots of data. Remember, one of the objectives was to reevaluate the soil test critical level of potassium using that Malik 3 test. And so just as a little refresher, there's two parts to soil test development. It's correlation and calibration. Correlation is the process where we determine the relationship between plant nutrient uptake and yield, or yield, and the amount of nutrient that's extracted using a particular soil test, such as the Malik 3 test. And then the second part of that is calibration, and this is how we determine how much fertilizer is needed at a given soil test level. And so for this, we have to calculate relative yield. Relative yield was calculated by dividing the yield of our check plot by that of the greatest treated plot. If we have a relative yield less than 100, this should mean that we have a responsive site because that treated yield was greater than the check yield. If it's greater than 100, that means that it should be a non-responsive site. A linear plateau model was used to do the correlation part of this. And for this data set that I'm presenting, Galen had additional sites from 2012 to 2014 that was added into the data set to just increase the number of observations that we had. So we increased that to 68 total observations. And so what we got once we did this, running the linear plateau model, is we were able to determine what that new critical level should be. So if you could recall, I've said it multiple times, it is or was currently at the 125 milligrams of K per kilogram of soil. Based on our data set, we should be closer to 200 milligrams of K per kilogram of soil. This is at the 0 to 6 inch depth. If we use 0 to 12 and 0 to 24 inches, both of those are right around that same 200 part per million K, like the 0 to 6 inch depth was. So in summary, what we've observed, like I said, lots of data, so lots to take in, but that our lower yielding sites tended to be more responsive. So if you remember, Williamson County in Texas and Virginia, both of those were more responsive, and they are in that lower yielding range. The yield response was not consistently observed, however. That's what makes us a little concerned with the data set. I think there's lots of variability in it. And so moving forward, we really have several more questions to answer when it comes to potassium. And potassium isn't something new. Lots of you that have been sitting in the room for the last 10, 15 years know that potassium is something that comes and goes as far as topics that we're researching I'm a bit hard-headed and determined and do want to figure out more about what's going on in the soil. Is it more of a mineralogy thing? Is it a texture thing? What is causing this variability in response from one site to the other, especially in those sites with low K levels where we're not seeing a consistent response? And then also the question of why are we seeing a response in locations that are in the 200, 300 part per million potassium range? Those are sites that should have ample potassium available for the plant, but yet we're still seeing responses to potassium applications. And so in that case, does it go back more to the soil testing methods, how we're extracting that potassium, and are we overestimating what's truly plant available or what will become available during the growing season? If we look at the application rate and the method comparisons, we did see a greater yield increase with that 80 pounds of K2O per acre more consistently than those other rates. Texas and North Carolina were more responsive to the injected potassium applications versus the broadcast applications. And then Virginia responded more consistently to the broadcast application versus the injected application. So based on this data, the question is, should we increase our potassium critical levels? Well, Galen Morgan and I, before he went to Cotton Incorporated, met with our soil testing lab, and they have now increased their critical level from 125 parts per million up to 175 parts per million K. So with that, I'd like to thank our funding sources, Cotton Incorporated, what was IPNI, the Fluid Fertilizer Foundation, and of course Delta Pine for seed contributions and our cooperators as well.
We're running tight on time.
Okay. Well, I'd be happy to answer those later.